tall order for me to be able to have a clear understanding of where we're going in Daniel, but I appreciate those sentiments, and I'm hoping the Lord answers that prayer. But as we study together, I do hope to have some input. There are some things I'd like to bring to our attention throughout the course of this study, and as we continue further along in Daniel, as if you've read the chapter, then you understand, dealing with some very odd goings-on. These are the dreams that Daniel's going to record for us, visions and dreams. After chapter 6, Daniel's life, as we really know it, comes to an end during the reign of King Cyrus of Persia. We don't know at what point in time exactly that occurred, but that's how the last verse of chapter 6 concludes with Daniel prospering into the reign of Cyrus, king of Persia. So with chapter 7, we're going to jump into these dreams that Daniel has and these dreams that he's recounting. If you've ever studied through the book of Revelation, you're probably going to notice that some of the things that we're reading about in the subsequent chapters of Daniel are going to be very similar to what was read in Revelation, and probably just as confusing. And that's because chapters 7 through 12 are written in somewhat what we call apocryphal language or symbolic language. And a lot of John's revelation was actually borrowed from Daniel. He uses some of the terminology and some of the ideas that Daniel sets forth in Daniel's chapter 7 through 12, and he brings those to light because their fulfillment is much nearer in the book of Revelation than they are in Daniel. It's important for us to understand that anytime we engage in a study like this where you're looking at apocalyptic literature, as Daniel chapter 7 through 12 would be considered, it isn't always to be understood literally. There's a lot of things that Daniel uses in this symbolic language to describe these visions and dreams that if you read them through a literal eye with a literal interpretation, it will lead you down some false conclusions, lead you to have some false ideas. And as we noticed with Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, although they were spoken in literal terms in which we can understand, the manifestation and the fulfillment of that dream was actually something literal, something that was going to come to pass. That is, in that particular instance, the fall of the Babylonian Empire. Although he dreamed about this great statue with four different parts and four different metals, it actually was representative or symbolized the falling of the Babylonian Empire and the rising up of the Medo-Persian. And so as we engage in these chapters, we want to be careful as to how we read and how we interpret some of the language that Daniel uses, because it's symbolic and it's representative of things that are going to be taking place. You know, the problem with people taking this literally, your premillennialist, a lot of your premillennialist doctrine really comes from Daniel and comes from the book of Revelation. And it comes from a literal interpretation of those passages. And so we're not going to be really worried too much about the premillennial ideas that come from this. We may mention them in passing, or if you have questions about them, you can bring those up at the time. I'm not going to promise any immediate answers, but worst case, we can discuss those, or I can study those and we can talk about them in the next class. More so what I'm concerned with is the true interpretation of Daniel's vision and coming to the conclusion of what that is. Chapter 7 is relatively easy, so we're going to somewhat ease into this, but chapters 8 through 12, the interpretation is going to become a little more challenging. So we'll be putting forth some ideas. I'd be happy, very happy to entertain interpretations or ideas from you as long as they're not too weird as we proceed to those various chapters. So this is a study. Hopefully I'm not going to be simply the only one teaching, but that I can share in the discussion process as well, and hopefully the learning process as well. So let me just provide you, because as you read through this chapter, it is somewhat confusing, the elements and the language that Daniel uses. So I'm going to just jump ahead a little bit. I'm just going to give you really a very concise summation of Daniel's dream, the fulfillment of Daniel's dream in chapter 7. Now, I won't always be able to do this, so I wanted to do it while I can. But let me just very briefly read for you the interpretation. So as we're discussing these various elements, you don't lose sight of what the fulfillment's going to be. That is, we don't lose sight of the forest for the trees as we're looking into individual elements of Daniel's dream. So here's a summary of Daniel's dream in chapter 7. It's a successive king or kingdoms that are symbolized by these four strange creatures which have acted arrogantly against God and have often treated his people in a brutish fashion. Eventually, we'll have gone as far as God will allow and must someday face certain divine retribution for their crimes. It's not enough that they should be chastised and their power merely curbed for a time. They must finally and utterly be destroyed. God will bring them into judgment once and for all. In place of these savage earthly entities, the Lord will establish his own righteous and eternal kingdom under the rule of the Son of Man. So that is a summary fulfillment of what we're going to look at for the next few weeks in Daniel chapter 7. Now, I want you to be able to keep that at the forefront of your mind, because that is what it's pointing toward. And so as we're discussing these various elements of the dream, you won't get lost or bogged down in the details, because you'll be able to call to mind the fulfillment of the dream. So let's go ahead and jump into the text in Daniel chapter 7. If you're not there, please open up your Bibles. And we're going to read verses 1 through 8. Dustin, would you read that for us, please?
In the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the son of the matter. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea, and four great waves came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet, as if as man, and a man's part was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings for a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth, and devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. Diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first ones plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things.
Okay, so in verse 1, we're introduced here to the point in time Daniel had this vision. This is the first one that was recorded in 7 through 12. Previously, the only interpretation that Daniel has had was the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the second dream of Nebuchadnezzar, where he was judged by God, you might say, where he saw the great tree that was cut down. And then the interpretation of the writing on the wall by King Belshazzar, who we read about in chapter 5. So that's the only recorded examples of Daniel's interpretation of dreams. And you may notice in chapters 1 through 6, the more historical portion of the text, who was the interpreter? Daniel was the interpreter, blessed by God to be able to bring to fruition the understanding of these dreams and the mysteries. In chapters 7 through 12, Daniel is the one having these dreams. And who we're going to find interpreting these dreams is not Daniel himself, but rather is going to be angels. And so Daniel serves for interpreters in chapters 1 through 6. Angels are going to serve as interpreters, as we're going to see, of Daniel's dreams and visions in chapters 7 through 12. And so we're told here in verse 1 of chapter 7 the time frame of the dream that Daniel had. It was during the first year of Belshazzar. This is late into Daniel's life. Daniel came to Babylon probably 14 to 16 years old during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 44 years in Babylon, and then for the next several years there were rising ups, short reigns of kings, until finally a king by the name of Nabonidus sat on the throne in Babylon. Now, in his third reign, he left for the city of Tyre, and his son, Belshazzar, was placed at the head. And so Daniel was looking to be probably about 67 years old at the point in time that he has this first vision that's described for us in Daniel chapter 7. Belshazzar is really the straw that broke the camel's back for the Babylonian Empire. Through his actions, through his feasting, by bringing in all of the goods of the tabernacle and the temple of the Lord, and disgracing God and spitting in the face of all of the Jews and the Israelites and their God and their religion, he brought down judgment on Babylon. It was because of that that God judged Babylon and took the kingdom away from them that very night that celebration occurred. And so as you stop and you think about it, it's during the reign of Belshazzar that Daniel receives this dream. And then verse 1 tells us that he wrote these points down. He wrote down the main thoughts of the dream. We don't necessarily know why it was at this point in time that Daniel received the dream. It could be because of the political instability in Babylon. In 7 years, they'd seen the rise and fall and assassination of three different kings. Nebuchadnezzar before them reigned for 44 years. And so that offered, at least for the Israelites who were held captive, a sense of stability. And no doubt at this point in time, as these Babylonian kings are rising and falling and killing each other, they're wondering what's about to happen to us. And maybe God has given this vision to Daniel to kind of offer them some stability, to let them know what's going to be coming. And especially when Belshazzar took the throne. He was a man that was foolish and that was prideful, that went beyond anything Nebuchadnezzar demonstrated during his reign as king. And no doubt the Jews are very concerned about their future. What's going to happen to us as a nation? It had been promised and it had been prophesied that they were only going to be in bondage for some 70 years. And so they're wondering, with this guy Belshazzar at the helm, what's going to happen to this nation? What's going to happen to us? Is God really going to hold good on his promise that we're going to be able to return to our land, back to Judah? And so perhaps it's for this reason that Daniel now has these dreams that's going to foretell, in a sense, the goings-on of the world and the things that are going to be taking place. We don't know. We can only guesstimate. Maybe that's why Daniel received it. Maybe God just decided it was at this point in time Daniel needed to know these things. And then it was said that he wrote down the dream telling the main facts. So he didn't record everything that he saw, but he did write some things down. Why do you think it was that Daniel took the time to even bother with this? Why did he stop and record these things, write them down? That's one of our questions, so we'll open it up for discussion. Okay. Well, we are told later that he was told to seal up the words that he had written. So we know that God was at least involved in that process. So very well could have been at the command of God that he recorded these things because God wanted them preserved. Good point. Any other thoughts? Okay. And so he wrote down probably what he saw as the main points, and I think that somehow in some interpretations read verse 1 that he wrote down the main points. And this was relatively common for the prophets, to write down the things that they were told and what they witnessed in the dreams for multiple reasons. When you write something down, especially a prophet of God, when a prophet of God wrote something down, it established it as solid. It established it as something that was certain, something was going to be fulfilled. And you think about it, generations or people that after the time of Daniel, we don't know how widespread his letters might have been, whether copies might have been made and they might have been given out to the Israelites, whether they might have been read to the Israelites perhaps during this time of political instability when they needed hope and they needed reminding that God's going to hold true and God's promise is going to be fulfilled and you don't need to worry about King Belshazzar. God is going to accomplish what he desires. It could have given hope to that current generation. And not only that, it would have provided vindication later on for when Daniel is going to be referenced like Jesus references Daniel. Well, if Daniel had never recorded any of those things, then Daniel would be nothing more than a fictional character. There'd be nothing to go, no historical documents that could be provided that were actually attributed to the prophet Daniel. And so it provided vindication for God and his prophet in later years. Not only that, as Paul tells us, the things that were written before, they were written for our learning. They're for our benefit as well. And as we look at prophecy, especially as we're going to see in Daniel, these here where you've got God before events occur, you've got God foretelling divinely certain events that were going to occur throughout the history of the world. That's validating for our faith. That's strengthening for our faith because it shows there the omniscience and the foresight of God to be able to do that. And that's why we spent so much time in the early part of this book in the introduction in establishing a solid date for when Daniel was written. Because if you can understand that Daniel was written during the 6th century and you've got foretelling of events hundreds of years before they occur, that is strong evidence that this book is truly inspired by God, that God's hand truly was behind the things that Daniel recorded. And so for multiple reasons, Daniel would have wrote these things down for his generation, for following generations, and for us today. We're able to benefit from the writings of Daniel. Now, we may read through this and we may say, well, what in the world good does this do for me? Well, we're going to try to unravel a little bit some of the mysterious elements that Daniel speaks of here. So, he has this vision. These four winds are stirred up from the Great Sea, probably the Mediterranean Sea, as they would have known it, as they would have described it. And so, we see these four great beasts arising. So, let's look at and consider another question. What were the four beasts that Daniel saw? What did they represent? Miss Johnny? Okay. They were representative of four kingdoms. And you go back to chapter 2, we said chapter 2 last week parallels very well with chapter 7, where you got the statue in chapter 2 with four metals, and you've got here these four beasts. And there's just a lot of elements in chapters 2 and 7 that correspond well one to another. That picture's not near as good as I thought it was going to be. It's supposed to be an artist's rendition of these four beasts that Daniel's going to describe for us. And as Sister Johnny pointed out, these four beasts were going to represent four kingdoms. And as you read through this, you're looking at some weird stuff here. Each beast is going to represent a kingdom. And you may wonder, well, what's this? Why did Daniel see this odd lion-looking creature? Why did it have wings? And this leopard with four heads and four wings, well, what's that about? Well, we're going to look at some of those elements and see how they really tie into what history is going to reveal for us later on. So verse 23, I think, of chapter 7 tells us that the beasts are representative of kingdoms. And you may say, well, where in the world does he get that information? How do we know these beasts are representative of kingdoms? Verse 23 of chapter 7 says, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth. And so that tells us that the beasts are representative of kingdoms that are going to come on the earth. So that's what they were representative of. So let's just take a few moments and look at the various beasts in the vision that Daniel saw. The first beast, and once again, going back to what we looked at very much in chapter 2, remember that head of gold on that statue? We've got this first beast, which is the lion with wings that corresponds to that head of gold that Daniel dreamed about, or Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about in chapter 2. All right. Understanding the significance of a lion being representative of Babylonia, we have to go back once again and look at history a little bit. During the days of King Nebuchadnezzar, behind the Ishtar Gates, which was a part of the entrance into the city of Babylon, he had just numerous statues of lions set up that were just representative of what he thought of his country. And you think about a lion, you think of the characteristics of a lion, and this is something that's held true throughout all time. When you think of lions, what kind of characteristics do you think about?
Strong,
fierce, forceful, aggressive, powerful. And so, no doubt Nebuchadnezzar, being the great king that he was, conquering all of these other lands and increasing the boundaries of his kingdom like no one else before him, he views himself, his nation, as a mighty, powerful, fierce lion, just devouring all the prey. It's a symbol of strength and it's a symbol of courage. And when you look at what King Nebuchadnezzar did with the Babylonian Empire, it's very well representative of what they were able to accomplish. Now, you may wonder, well, what's this lion doing with these eagle wings? Well, if you look at how Nebuchadnezzar is described in Jeremiah, and you'll remember, Jeremiah was somewhat of a contemporary of the prophet Daniel. He did prophesy prior to Babylon's captivity and well into Babylon's captivity of the Jews. But speaking of and warning the nation of the Jews regarding King Nebuchadnezzar and the judgment that was about to come upon them, look how he describes it. He says, and he describes Babylon as a lion. The lion has come up from his thicket. The destroyer of nations is on his way. He's gone forth from his place to make your land desolate. Your cities will be laid away without inhabitants. So even Daniel, before Babylon came and took the Jews into captivity, Jeremiah referred to the land of Babylon, the nation of Babylon, as a mighty lion. And you may wonder, well, where did the wings come from? And I just said that a moment ago. A few verses later in chapter 4, behold, he shall come up like clouds, and his chariot like a whirlwind. His horses are swifter than eagles. Woe to us, for we are plundered. And so when you think of this lion, this powerful beast, this powerful creature, and you see that it's got wings on it, those wings are representative of moving with swiftness, moving with power. And if you think about those two elements, the lion and the wings of an eagle that the lion had, strength and might, speed and power. And that was somewhat descriptive of the Babylonian Empire during its early years of conquest. Nebuchadnezzar would just swiftly go from nation to nation, and he'd win battle after battle after battle, increasing the borders of his kingdom. And so this lion with these eagle wings are representative of what he was able to accomplish as a nation. And really further evidence that makes it quite obvious that we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar here is, Dustin was reading, you noticed there's some divine intervention. You got this lion, this mighty beast with these wings that's moving about swiftly devouring its prey. Dominion is given to it. Land is given to it. Its wings were clipped, were said. And in it was placed the heart of a man. And so it began to rise up and walk like a man. And if you think about the mighty Babylonian Empire, for a while they soared great in the heavens. And they were powerful
for a time. But at a point in time after the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, they were brought back down to earth. What was once ferocious and swift and powerful was given way to meekness and to the condescension of humanity, in that its wings were clipped. And this calls to mind the event in chapter 4 that we read about, where mighty King Nebuchadnezzar was humbled by God. He was stricken with some sort of madness, and he went out to live among the beasts of the field. The mighty lion, you might say, was humbled, was brought back down to earth. And successive kings that came up after Nebuchadnezzar proved it to be nothing like Nebuchadnezzar had been, nothing like their forefather. Rather, they simply proved to be ordinary men. And it really culminates with Belshazzar, under whose feeble hand the kingdom of Babylon is essentially given way to the Medes and the Persians. And so you see how the various elements of the dream that Daniel describes fits perfectly with that of the Babylonian Empire. Any thoughts, comments, questions on the first beast? Okay, I hope that's clear. I hope you're able to see there how the elements that Daniel's describing or is witnessed in this dream really help us understand that's the Babylonian Empire. The second creature that Daniel saw, in verse 5, he describes for us, it was a bear that rises up on one side that's got three ribs in its mouth. It was equivalent to the silver arms and the silver chest that we saw back in Daniel chapter 2. You think of a bear, it's ferocious, but it's slower. It doesn't have the same nobility that a lion possessed. It's slow, it's heavy, and it's ungainly, but bears are relatively quick whenever they're chasing after their prey, but they kind of just plod along if they're not hunting after anything in particular. And so in contrast to the lion, which had the wings and moved with swiftness, and as we're going to look at the next beast that had four wings and was like a leopard that moved with extreme swiftness, you've got this plodding bear that comes onto the scene. And he's got three ribs in his mouth, vestiges of his last kill. And we see for this bear, it was given dominion for a period of time as well. Now, there was one interesting detail that I wanted to note in verse 5. The second sentence there, that bear raised up on one side. And you think, well, what does that little detail there describe? The second nation to arise and to overthrow the Babylonians was who? Okay, Medes and Persians. The bear rises up on one side. And what you look when you go through history, you're going to find out that that alliance of the Mede and the Persian is quickly going to be dissolved. It's going to turn out to be the Persians who are really the true powerhouse this next point in time. And the Medes are just going to kind of fade into the background. I think that's probably what's representative there. That bear rises up on one side. One side's powerful. One side's active. One side's ready to go. That's going to be representative of the Persian nation that would rise up and would dissolve this alliance between the Medes and the Persian. And they would be the ones who really arises as the dominant nation. And the Medes are just going to kind of fall to the background. And this bear was given the command to arise and devour much flesh. The Persians are going to put 8 separate kings onto the throne. And during that time, like the Babylonians, they're going to capture and raid and grow and expand their dominion. Remember, once again, at the command or at the behest in this dream, this bear is commanded, arise, devour much flesh. And that's what we see represented or fulfilled during the reign of the Persian Empire. So that's the creature described there that Daniel witnessed. The third beast being a leopard. It's got 4 heads, and this is an odd-looking creature if you even try to envision this. This leopard with 4 heads and 4 wings. Well, we understand the wings to be representative of speed. That's kind of used symbolically in prophetic and apocalyptic language. So if you consider the fact the lion had 2 wings and he moved with great speed, you think of a leopard. A leopard's faster than a lion. It's sleek, it's quick, it can move very fast, and it's got 4 wings versus the 2 that the lion had. So it's going to move with even greater speed than that which the lion had. Now you stop and you understand the world power that succeeded the Persians was who? The Greeks. Yeah. Who came at the forefront of the Greeks? Who's representative in our minds of the Greek king that really brought them to power, that made them great? Okay, I think a lot of people knew that. Alexander the Great, exactly. Alexander the Great's conquest of the Greek Empire took 10 short years. Nebuchadnezzar was king for 44, and he expanded Babylon to greatness. He operated quickly, but he didn't have anything regarding speed in the conquest of Alexander the Great. It took Alexander the Great 10 years, 10 short years, to really expand the Greek Empire to greatness. And so you see there,
The four wings on the back of the leopard, it moved with great swiftness. Its dominion was taken very quickly versus the preceding Medo-Persian and the preceding Babylonian Empire. And so that's representative of the great speed in which they conquered the earth, or they conquered the lands at that point in time. But you may wonder, okay, well, what were those four heads representative of? Well, after Alexander the Great died, he died, we don't know why, some mysterious illness after a relatively short life and a relatively short reign, the empire kind of just went downhill at that point in time. And it was divided into four separate units: Greece and Macedon, Thrace and Asia Minor, Asia and Palestine, Egypt and Palestine, each of those having a separate ruler. And so that's what the four heads of the leopard represent, were the four divisions after Alexander the Great died that the Greek Empire became separated into. And so you see here, this is really impressive. As you understand, when Daniel was written, hundreds of years before the Grecian Empire even begins to move into this position of greatness as a world power, you've got God showing Daniel beforehand various things that are going to be fulfilled. And as you trace down through history, history corroborates what we're looking at here, in that the Grecian Empire was indeed gained and grew very quickly, and then later was divided into four separate components, four different parts. So they didn't possess the same strength as the one before. Then things kind of take a turn for the interesting in the vision. And Daniel's going to focus a lot of his attention in this portion of the chapter, as well the later portion of the chapter. He's going to want to know more about this beast right here, this fourth beast that is going to be the Roman Empire. I'll stop and consider question four. How is the fourth beast different than the other three? Okay. Okay.
And I think the way it was set up would last longer and stronger.
Okay.
And that's rib, nothing like it before.
That's true. That's kind of the idea you get here. You look at each of the previous beasts that Daniel's witnessed. They had some sort of similarity to some known animal, didn't they? A lion, although a weird lion with wings. A leopard with four heads and with wings, but it was like a leopard that he could relate it to. A bear, all of those had some zoological classification, you might say. But then this fourth beast comes along. Well, he didn't describe it to look similar to another animal, does he? He describes some of the things he sees. He describes it, as Tommy pointed out, as dreadful and terrible, and it's got these great iron teeth. And once again, this really ties in, as you see well, with chapter 2. Chapter 2, we had that vision of the four-part statue. The bottom part were legs of iron. Remember that? And this beast here is described as having great iron teeth. Not only that, but this creature here seems to be wreaking more havoc and seems to be more powerful and more dreadful than the previous creatures that Daniel's witnessed and that Daniel's described. Not only is it devouring with those great iron teeth, but you know, it says it's stomping with its feet. And so it's killing with its mouth, it's killing with its feet. Every part of this creature is just seeking to rip and to destroy and tear. And it's more devastating and more terrible than those beasts that came before it. And also it was said to be different than all of the ones that came before it, in that it didn't have a similarity to some other zoological form. And we see that Daniel's going to talk about another weird or abnormality that this fourth beast possesses that we're going to focus on. Daniel's going to want to know more about later. This particular beast, this fourth one, had 10 horns on his head. Does anyone know what horns represent when you go back to the Old Testament? You look kind of at a prophetic language. It's symbolic for something. And Zechariah sheds a little bit of light for that. So Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 18 through 21. I raised my eyes. Now we're at a separate vision. This isn't Daniel's vision, but this is going to help us understand what the horns on the fourth beast represent. I raised my eyes and looked, and there were four horns. I said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these?" So he answered and said, "These are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem." And the Lord showed me four craftsmen, and I said, "What are they coming to do?" And he said, "These are the horns that scattered Judah so that no one could lift up his head. But the craftsmen are coming to terrify them, to cast out the horns of the nation that lifted up their horn against the land of Judah to scatter." So we see, you take away from this, these horns are scattering the nations. What horns are representative of, most oftentimes, symbolically in these prophetic languages, horns are representative of power. And that falls in line with what
Daniel was described for us. This fourth beast possesses great power, great iron teeth. It's trotting around, it's stomping, and it's destroying everything it comes in contact with. And on its head are these 10 horns. These 10 horns, which are representative of the power, and are later going to be identified in the chapter as 10 kings that come about. So this description here of this creature that Daniel witnessed, this fourth creature Daniel witnessed, it signifies a singularly voracious, cruel, mighty, powerful, vindictive royal power. Now, when you go back and you look at the history of the nation of Rome, it's supported by the voice of history that you look at Rome and you look at how it was different than the preceding kings before it. The Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and the Babylonians. There was a phrase that circulated regarding the Battle of Carthage. And the Roman perspective, the Roman phrase that was circulated during that point in time was this: Carthage must be destroyed. That was the way that they approached battle. That was the way that they approached their rule. They didn't rule by, they ruled by a domineering iron fist. And so that was their mentality. And you go back and you look at the Battle of Carthage, it wasn't just defeat and captivity, it was brutal destruction. That was the mentality which they approached and in which that kingdom thrived. This idea that we've got to absolutely wipe them out from the history of the world. They've got to be destroyed. And when you read about this creature here that Daniel witnessed, this fourth creature, it's devouring with its teeth and it's stomping out everything that's around it. Very well representative of what history is going to tell us about the Roman Empire. Not only that, but you look at the others. Babylon didn't rule as a nation for that long. Maybe close to 100 years. Not even 100 years, I don't think. Shortly after them, the Medes and the Persians came along, and the Persians arise as a dominant nation. They reign for 100, 150 years. The Greeks come along, their reign isn't very long. But you come to the Roman Empire. Rome stood as a world power from about 241 BC until its fall in 410 AD. And even then, it continued to persist as a nation. But it ruled as a world power for about 650 years. That's a lot different than all of the other nations that came before it. And so you may be wondering, well, what's significant about the 10 horns? And we're going to talk about the 10 horns. We're going to have to do that next week because we're out of time. But we're going to next week pick up with the 10 horns. And we're actually going to look at that more later in the chapter. We'll briefly have a comment or two regarding that. But we're going to focus next week a little bit on that little horn that Daniel sees and describes coming up on that fourth beast. So I hope the things we've looked at this morning were clear. History corroborates pretty well the things that Daniel has described for us. And it's interesting, it's always interesting to me to see how the Bible, a book given by God, just fits hand in glove with history. History corroborates and describes these things and helps us appreciate that these things were true. Does anyone have thoughts, comments, or questions that they'd like to add? Anything that we've looked at in chapter 7, verses 1 through 8? Anything that was unclear that we might need to readdress? All right. Appreciate everyone's attention and participation in our study this morning. We'll pick up next.